My name is Jack, and I am an alcoholic. This is some church basement you got here, Ted. I am a member of the Hagerstown group of Alcoholics Anonymous, cleverly named, don't you think? We are the third oldest group in the state of Maryland. We meet on Mondays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. We do a big book on Mondays, steps on Thursday, and open discussion or anniversaries on Saturday. If you're in Hagerstown, come see us. I kind of was interested in the way Ted characterized the speakers. He said we've had some really good ones thus far. I know you got a great one tomorrow, and I agree with thus far. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to be here. I guess maybe more specifically, I want to thank the committee for allowing Mike to invite me to be here. I think it's important that you know who is responsible for my being here, because if I say anything that offends you in the next 2.5 hours, you take it up with Mike, because he's the one who invited me. So I'm going to put my watch up here, not because I can see it or pay any attention to it. I just think it gives hope to the newcomer, and I think that's important. I think it's real important that you probably all know this, but in case somebody gets hold of a CD or a tape of this lead, that you know that I am not a spokesperson for Alcoholics Anonymous, nor am I an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous. Actually, there's even some confusion about why I'm even here, and not the least of which is they usually have a good speaker on Saturday night, and not this year, but maybe next year. My mom is going to be 91 years old in 10 days, and I talked to her. Thank you. I talked to her earlier this evening, and my mother is very confused as to why you all would invite me to be here with you this evening. My mom was married to my alcoholic father for 30 years, and she knows what an alcoholic is. And my mom tells me I'm not an alcoholic, and I want to listen to my mom. Part of my confusion about why I'm invited here is because, and I want you to know, if I'd have known that this had so much cachet, I would have tried a lot harder. But I have never been to prison. I have never been to jail. I've never had a drunk driving arrest or a driving under the influence arrest. I've never lost a job because of my drinking. My wife is here this evening, and if I don't screw this thing up, we'll be married 40 years come August. You may want to give her a chip for that after I finish this chat. She's here this evening in her capacity as lie detector. So if you see her jump up, you know something's going on. So I don't have any multiple marriages as a result of drinking. I don't have any children born out of wedlock. I've never lost a job, as I say, because of my drinking. I don't even have a good tattoo. And you're probably just as confused as my mother as to why I'm here. And we'll try to allay some of that confusion. I said that my wife and I are going to be married 40 years come August if I don't screw this thing up. I want to introduce three people to you who are very near and dear to us. My wife and I were introduced on a blind date. My roommate from college married her roommate from college, and they fixed us up at the University of Maryland on a blind date. And I'd like you to welcome our good friends, Joyce and Tom, and their son, Matt, who are seated down front here. Quite frankly, when we were in college and I was just getting started in this drinking business, I always thought if I ever got as bad as Tom, I was going to quit. And don't you know, he quit anyway, you know? And he's not even one of us. Can't believe it. Tom, you should have hung in there, man. I think you could have made it. I really do. My dad, as I said, was an alcoholic, and here's an event that happened in my life that was, you'll see, played an important role in my life. I was 14 years old. My mom and my sister were out for the evening, and my dad and I were home alone, and he was trying to get me to do something that I didn't want to do, and as hard as it is, I know for some of you to believe, I was somewhat stubborn and hard-headed even as a 14-year-old, and I refused to do what my father wanted me to do until he started to negotiate with me, and he said, "Son, if you'll do this thing for me, I'll do whatever you want me to do." "What is it, son, that you'd want me to do?" And I said, "Dad, I'd like you to quit drinking." And he thought about that for a minute, and he said, "You know, you're absolutely right. Drinking's causing us a lot of trouble. Your mom's after me to quit drinking, and I think the business would go better if I wasn't drinking. So, okay, I'll make that deal with you, son. I'm going to quit drinking." Now, I got to tell you, I was just ecstatic. I had been praying to God that my father would stop drinking. And this was an answer to prayer, absolutely. And when my mom and my sister got home that night, I met them at the front door, and I told them, "Our troubles are over. Dad and I have had a talk. He has agreed to quit drinking, and joy reigned supreme in our house that night." I know my mom had been praying that my dad would quit drinking. I know my sister had been praying. There was a God, and he was loving and caring and gracious, and he had granted our petition. And the next day, my dad got drunk, and I closed the door on God. I didn't want to have anything to do with a God that would play fast and loose with the feelings of a family like that. I didn't know why, but apparently I was unworthy. Certainly my prayers were unworthy, and I didn't want to have anything to do with a God that was like that. I knew if I was ever going to be anything in this world, if I was ever going to make anything of myself in this world, it was going to have to be all me, all by myself, on my own. And I set out to do so. It wasn't very long after that that I was introduced to beverage alcohol for the first time. And my guess is that it did for me very much what it did for you if you're an alcoholic. I mean, I always felt a little out of place. I always felt that I was the odd person in the room. But with a couple of drinks, I mean, I could do things that I had no ability to do when I was not drinking. I mean, I could engage in social conversations. I could talk to people. More importantly, I could talk to girls. And I could dance. I mean, I could dance. Not drinking, I could not dance. Joyce, remember our one night dance contest in college? You bet. We were terrific. I digress. I thought I could sing. Not as good as Angie, mind you, but I thought I could sing. I heard somebody from the podium not long ago say that when they drank, the pimples fell off and their boobs got big. I had the pimple experience. I did not have the boob experience. But alcohol for me was the elixir of life. It was a solution to life's problems. Where have they been keeping this stuff? I mean, no wonder my father drank. I mean, I did feel sorry for him that he couldn't control it. But my goodness, this is it for me, buddy. And I'm going to do this as often as I can, as much as I can, whenever I can. And that became a real controlling thing in my life. I didn't know it then. I certainly know it now. An indication that maybe there was something going wrong from the very beginning is I spent 5 years in high school. I'd like to think it was a result of a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, but as I look back on it now, it would appear that alcohol had a lot to do with it. I got thrown out of a lot of classes in school. I got sent away for a little while, for 18 months, but they released me early, and I came back to high school 18 years of age, which made me the most popular guy in my senior class, because you could buy beer in West Virginia at 18, and we only live about 10 miles from West Virginia. So when I started community college, and one summer, my good friend and I had determined we wanted to go to California. We were going to take a road trip. And so we had packed up my car. We had 12 cases of beer in my car, and we had a little overnight bag, each of us, everything you need to have to drive to California. So I had quit my job. I had a pocket full of money. And the night before we were to leave to go to California, my friend's father wouldn't let him go. And so what's a guy to do when he's quit his job, got a pocket full of money and a car full of beer? Well, if you're in Maryland, you may know that Maryland has a little strip of its eastern border on the Atlantic Ocean. And that is, we have a town there called Ocean City. And so I went down to Ocean City. And in Ocean City, I had friends who were working there. They were working in hotels, so they let me sleep in the basement for free. I had friends who were working in restaurants, and they let me eat leftover restaurant food. And so all of my time, effort, and energy was focused on drinking those 12 cases of beer in my car and then spending the money that I had to buy whatever I needed to refurbish my supply. I enjoyed my, I was living as a bum in Ocean City is what I was doing, but I was a keen observer of the social scene, and I decided that I really would like to go to work in Ocean City, and that was what I was going to do the next summer, but the question was, what kind of job would I get? And I can tell you this, if you go to Ocean City, it doesn't make any difference if you're a lifeguard or a beach boy, a waiter or a waitress, a bartender. It does not make any difference. If you drank like I drank and acted like I acted, they would arrest you. And I noticed there was one group of people who were working in Ocean City who were not getting arrested. And they were the Ocean City policemen. So I became an Ocean City policeman the following year. They assigned me a boardwalk beat, and I had only been working for a couple of days when it became clear that I possess a singularly unique talent, and that is I can spot an underage drinker from at least 100 yards. And I would spot one of these underage drinkers, and I would approach them, and I would determine that indeed, in fact, looking at their false ID, that they were, in fact, underage. And then we begin the discussion about what was in the cooler. And, of course, you open up the lid of the cooler, and there displayed, laid out in neat rows, are the Coca-Colas or the Pepsis, maybe a little tuna fish and a loaf of bread. But I think you know and I know that when you reach way down in the bottom of that cooler, out comes the Budweiser. And when that Budweiser comes out, everything changes because, you see, you thought you were going to go to college, but you're not. You're going to jail. You thought you were going to go into the United States Army, but you're not. You're going to jail. We're going to call your parents at 3 a.m. to come down here to get you out of jail. Your life is over as you know it. Somewhere in that conversation, one of these folks would generally say something like, couldn't we come up with some alternative to this? Well, what is it you were going to suggest? And, officer, couldn't you just confiscate the beer? Confiscate the beer. Well, if I take the beer, I'm going to have to take the cooler. If I take the cooler, I'm going to take the tuna fish and, you know, the Coca-Cola. You can have it all. Well, okay, but I'm going to write your name down here, and don't you ever do this again. Now, you cannot walk a beat and drag coolers full of beer around behind you. So I had to work out an arrangement with my lieutenant and my sergeant, and that was I would call them. They'd come with a squad car. They'd take the cooler. They'd give it to me at the end of my shift, and if I happened to come up with any wine or whiskey, they got the wine and whiskey. That was a good arrangement for both of us, and it worked out really well. I didn't get arrested that summer. I didn't have to buy anything to drink that summer. I drank every day that summer, and that's my definition of a good summer at Ocean City. I had such a good time, I went back for a second year. They gave me a squad car. You can do a lot of damage with a squad car. First of all, you don't have to rely on your lieutenant and your sergeant so much because you got your own very big trunk and you can get a lot of coolers in there. Made me very popular with my fraternity brothers. They would come down to Ocean City for the weekend. Jack's rent-a-cooler business was available. We were open. And you didn't even have to return the cooler because I had plenty of coolers. No problem. Again, I had a good summer. Didn't get arrested. Didn't buy anything to drink all summer. Drank every day. So why not come back for a third year? Came back for a third year. I'm going to tell you an event right now that changed the course of my life. You probably had such benchmarks in your life. This one I can point to and say, this really made a difference. I was working a midnight to 8 shift. It was 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. I stopped a car on the beach highway for drunk driving. The driver was obviously drunk. I was writing up the ticket for drunk driving. And he looked up at me and he said, "You don't know who I am, do you, officer?" I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Well, I am the state's attorney for Worcester County, the county you're standing in right now." Well, I'm a college kid. I didn't have any idea what a state's attorney was or what they did. So I said, "Well, good for you. Sign the ticket." And he signed the ticket, and there was a fellow in the car who appeared to be sober, so he drove, and away they went. At 8 o'clock that morning, I pulled into the parking lot at the city hall where the Ocean City Police Department was located, and there standing in the parking lot was the chief of police. And as I exited my cruiser, he said, "Quarterman," he said, "come up to my office and bring that uniform citation book with you." Well, these were the first words the chief had spoken to me all summer. Seemed to me I was going to be getting some recognition for a job well done, long overdue recognition, I might add. So I went up to his office, and much to my surprise, as I walked into his office, seated on the couch right inside the door was the guy I gave the ticket to at 3 o'clock in the morning. Chief said, "Give me that ticket book." I handed him the ticket book. He flipped it open to the ticket I'd written. He handed it to the guy on the sofa. The guy on the sofa reached in his coat. He took out a pen, and he wrote across the face of that ticket, "Case dismissed." It was at that moment I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. And if I could be one of those state's attorneys, the ability to dismiss traffic charges with a stroke of a pen were going to come in mighty handy. So I went to law school. Law school interfered with my drinking somewhat, but I did graduate from law school, and I went back to my hometown of Hagerstown to practice law. I'd only been there a very short period of time. Then it became apparent that the state's attorney's office was advertising for an assistant state's attorney. So I rushed right over. And I said, "Here I am. I'm the answer to your prayers. Where do you want me to sign up? When should I start work?" Now, what I'm about to share with you is what I think they said to me. I know some of you understand that much of what I think happened in my life never really happened. that much of what I think I've heard people say to me has never been said to me. I just thought it was said to me. But this is what I thought I heard them say. Something like, "What? What? You just got out of law school. What, are you some kind of idiot? You've never tried a case. You've never interviewed a witness. You've never selected a jury. Get out of the office." That's what I thought I heard them say. Now, upon reflection, I believe they said something like, "The position has been filled." But I heard what I heard, and I walked out of there angered. Now, having been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I recognized that what I really had was a resentment. And there's nothing like an alcoholic with a good resentment. And in our community, I'm sure very much like your community, we elect our state's attorney. So I went out and found a lawyer who wanted to be state's attorney. I ran his campaign for state's attorney. He was elected state's attorney, and he made me deputy state's attorney. Well, I hadn't been in that office 10 minutes, and I discovered we had a serious problem, and that was we had no badges, and there's no point in being a state's attorney if you don't have a badge. So I designed a really great badge for the state's attorney's office, and when you get a badge, you get a badge case. And so you put that badge in there, and it's got this clear glass seam place where you drop your driver's license. So when they pull you over and they ask to see that license and registration, you just hold up that badge case with your driver's license in it. They don't look at that driver's license. They look at that badge. What kind of badge is that? Deputy State's Attorney, Washington County. Oh, no problem, officer. No, I understand. Yes, I'll slow it down. No, and I'm only going a couple more blocks here, so no, I'm almost home. No, sir, I'm not. No, I understand. You're just doing your job. I really appreciate the professional courtesy. Thank you so much. Good night. Now, you're probably getting some insight into why I don't have any DUI arrests on my record. Well, my boss, the state's attorney, was going to be appointed circuit court judge, and this was a good thing, I thought, because if he got to be circuit court judge, I was going to get appointed state's attorney. I don't know how it is in California, but back in Maryland sometimes, the state senator sticks his nose in where it doesn't belong and screws everything up. And that's what happened in this instance, and my friend, the state's attorney, didn't get appointed judge at all. Some other guy got appointed judge. And I was upset by that. Not so much that my friend didn't get to be appointed judge, but because he didn't get appointed judge, I didn't get to be state's attorney. Now, I don't know about you. I may not be much, but I'm all I think about. So one night, sitting around talking about the injustice of this whole situation with a couple of like-minded friends having a few adult beverages, it was determined that somebody ought to run against that state senator. So I ran for the state senate. I didn't know that the state senator was going to run off with the secretary from the Appropriations Committee and abandon his wife and children and move to Florida, but he did, and I got elected state senator. Now, in Maryland, when you get elected state senator, they give you a license plate, and on that license plate it says, State Senator. Now, this is an aid in efficient law enforcement, because when they come up behind you on the interstate with those overheads going, and they get close enough to see that license plate, they turn those overheads out. They pull up alongside, they turn that interior dome light on, and they toot. Beep, beep. Hi, Senator. Hi, Trooper. Hold it down, Senator. Okay, Trooper. And that way you don't have the state police tied up along the side of the highway when they could be out really arresting real criminals. I'd like to tell you about my legislative experience in Annapolis, but well, we have a group of people in Annapolis, our state capital, I'm sure very much like your state capital, Sacramento, whose only purpose for being is to make sure that any member of the House or Senate who has a desire to get something to drink alcoholic is able to do so. And these people are called lobbyists. And I had a lot of friends who were lobbyists, so anything that I would say to you about my legislative experience would be primarily hearsay and stuff that other people had told me, which I don't know if it's true or not. And I don't like to spread rumors in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, that guy that got appointed judge, he didn't like the job, and he didn't stay in it very long, and he resigned. And so I went to the governor, and I said, Governor, I'd like you to, I'm the state senator now, buddy, so I'd like you to appoint my friend, the state's attorney, I'd like you to appoint him judge. And the governor said, well, Senator, we're still very upset about all that adverse publicity that was generated back in that dust-up several years ago, and so I'm not going to appoint your guy judge. But if you'd like to be circuit court judge, I'll appoint you. Well, in Maryland, it's a 15-year term, and I was in a community that only had two judges, so it doesn't come around all that often, so I became a circuit court judge. Scary, isn't it? I want you to know that under my leadership as circuit court judge, Alcoholics Anonymous enjoyed a tremendous membership increase. Big spike in membership, because you remember I got that alcoholic father, and I know what to do with alcoholics, so I sent them all to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was responsible for a lot of that growth in our community. Now, keep it in mind, now, I'm drinking alcoholic all through this, all through this. I love drinking. I loved everything about drinking. I love the ambiance of drinking. I love the appropriate glass for the appropriate drink. You know, those tall, thin Tom Collins glasses, frosted, those cold tankards that they pull out of the freezer for the beer, you know. You know, those shaped martini glasses, those big olives with those big pits that you can only get in the large double martini. I loved everything about drinking. I did, however, have a bad gin experience one time, and to this day, it's hard for me to go into a pine forest. I loved Jack Daniel's Black Label on crushed ice with a twist of lemon. There are some of my people right out there. That was to die for, absolutely. However, if you thrust a brown paper bag my way and said, here, take a pull on this, I wouldn't ask you what's in there. Because there's no point in asking you, because you wouldn't have shoved it towards me if it wasn't good. So I'd take a pull on it. Ah, oh, man, that's good. Woo, good stuff. What is that? And you know how you have a barbecue over at the house, or some folks in to play poker or whatever, and you're cleaning up afterwards, and you got the beer cans around, and this one's about half full. You know, man, what was that? Cigarette butt. I thought there were some cigarette butt drinkers in here. Yeah, yeah. I loved everything about drinking. I saw no reason not to drink. I had no problem drinking. Other people might have had a problem with my drinking, but I'm a circuit court judge, so I got no problem with it. Give me some idea of how cooperative I tried to be with our bar association. They were having a continuing legal education program on the prosecution and defense of drunk driving. And the prosecutors were going to talk about their objects in the prosecutor's case. A defense attorney's going to talk about how they defend against drunk driving. Sergeant Long was there. He had his breathalyzer. The only thing they needed was a volunteer to drink the beer. Somebody who was impartial, unbiased, fair-minded. In 1982, a lawyer and I were going out. Stated purpose was we were going out to dinner. But this was one of those occasions that he and I had determined that we were going to go out and you were just going to get drunk. Not one of those situations where you find yourself being struck drunk by accident. This was deliberate. We were going to get drunk. We were going to get snot flying drunk. That's what we were doing. We were going to be drunk. And we did a good job of it. And we ended up in a place where a local cocktail lounge, which was frequented by most, if not all, of the recently separated, divorced, single, best-looking women in Washington County. We went in there just to get a nightcap, just to have a little something to, before we went home. And I got to tell you, if I had known that this was going to be my last drink, I would have ordered something different. If if I had known I was going to have to come to San Diego and confess this in front of all you, believe me, I would have ordered something different. It is with a great deal of embarrassment that I tell you that my last drink was Tia Maria. I know. Pretty weenie drink, I'll grant you that. In my defense, however, I will say that I'm pretty sure that that drink came from a tainted bottle. And the reason I know it was tainted was because I got sick to my stomach driving home. Now, I understand that sometimes you get sick to your stomach, like if you're drinking at 10, 11 o'clock, and you go out behind a broad axe and throw up behind a dumpster, and you go back in and you continue drinking. Because throwing up is part of drinking. I know that. And sometimes on Saturday mornings, most Saturdays actually, hugging that toilet in the bathroom on my knees, that's part of drinking, that Saturday morning thing. I understand that. By the way, is there anybody who's found anything to compare with the cool feel of porcelain on your cheek? Oh, my God. A year ago at Christmas, I apparently I ate something that disagreed with me, and I found myself with an upset stomach, and I was laying there with my head rested against the toilet, and I thought, oh, this feels so wonderful. I haven't done this for 23 years. And all that came rushing back. Anyway, I got sick going home, so I'm pretty sure it was a tainted bottle of Tia Maria. My wife is an elementary school teacher, and as you probably know, those elementary school children are just disease-infested, and they bring every germ in the community into the school, and then my wife brings those germs home. And when I got up on Thursday morning, it was another one of those situations where I had gotten sick as a result of her bringing back a flu bug, and I got up, I got the flu. And but hey, we go to work. If we can get there, we go to work. And I went to work that day. The next day was Good Friday, and I was off work, and so I was home. I had the upset stomach that goes with flu. By Saturday, my condition was not any better, although by that time I developed that lower tract distress that you frequently experience with flu. And if you got lower tract distress and an upset stomach at the same time, that's going to hone your decision-making down to a very fine edge. Because it was never clear to me exactly whether I should be sitting or kneeling or kneeling or sitting. And my wife tells me at least one occasion that weekend I made the wrong decision. Now, you can talk to her about that after I'm finished, but I'm moving on. I wasn't much better on Easter Sunday, and by Monday they had taken me to the hospital because I was dehydrated from all of that kneeling and sitting that I'd been doing. That night they performed an emergency laparotomy on me because my abdomen was distended. They found my abdomen full of peritonitis, gangrene, and while they were trying to clear that up, my kidneys quit, and my pancreas was digesting itself, and my liver was enlarged, and then my respiratory system quit. And so things weren't looking too good for the home team at that point. I spent 3 weeks in intensive care in the Hagerstown Hospital. My condition was deteriorating. The doctors came and they said that they were going to send me to Johns Hopkins, and I was very encouraged because I knew people who had gone to Johns Hopkins and they had come home, and I knew people who had gone to the Washington County Hospital and they had died. So since I wasn't doing very good in the Hagerstown Hospital, I thought Johns Hopkins sounded like a real good alternative. They told my wife, on the other hand, that they were sending me to Johns Hopkins to die, that they had there was nothing more that they could do for me in Hagerstown. They doubted that there was anything Hopkins could do for me. But if there was a slight chance of my survival, that's where they wanted to send me. Now, if they'd have told me that, I'd have been very discouraged by that, so I'm glad they didn't tell me. Got down to Hopkins, and for 2 weeks, they did everything but hang me by my thumbs. They did everything they knew to do. They presented me to the internal medicine department to see if they could get a vote on what I had. They couldn't get a majority vote for what my problem was. My belly button birthday is May the 14th. On May the 13th, these doctors came in to talk to me, and I said, before they could say anything, I said, I need a day of rest. Tomorrow is my birthday. Please, for God's sake, just leave me alone for one day. And they said, well, Judge, we don't know what to tell. We don't know what else to do for you. We've done everything. We just don't know what to do for you. So, yes, we came to tell you we're not going to do anything tomorrow. And so on May the 14th of 1982, I turned 40 years old in the Johns Hopkins Hospital. My wife went over to a stationery store in Baltimore, and she purchased a form lease. And she filled it out, and it was a lease between me and God. And she gave it to me as a birthday present. She said, here is your new lease on life. And 2 weeks later, I walked out of the Johns Hopkins Hospital. My kidney function returned. My liver function was lining up the way it was supposed to. My pancreas stopped digesting myself. They had taken me off the respirator before I got out of Hagerstown. And when you're in a hospital for 7 weeks like that, they want to talk to you before they send you home because they want to give you some do's and don'ts. But if you've got an undiagnosed illness, they really don't know what to tell you about them do's and don'ts because they're not sure about what you had. And it was my position then, and it's still my position today, that it's much better to survive an undiagnosed illness than to die of a known cause. I was just getting to leave those good doctors. They just told me, don't get it again, Judge. It's likely to kill you. And as I was getting ready to walk out of their office, the one doctor said to me, Judge, we got one more question for you, and that is, do you drink? What kind of question's that? I'm a lawyer. Well, I was a lawyer. Now I'm a judge. When I was a lawyer, I had to drink with clients, had to drink with other lawyers, had to drink with judges. Now I'm a judge. I got to drink with other lawyers. I got to drink with judges. It's a professional obligation. Of course I drink. How much? Not too much. Why? Well, we would like you to not drink for a while because alcohol really does a number on your kidneys, and your kidney functions return, but we don't know what's going to happen if you drank alcohol again. And, you know, the kidneys are one thing, but on top of that, you got your liver, and alcohol really does a number on the liver, and then, of course, there's your pancreas, which was digesting itself, and alcohol does a number on the pancreas, and we just think you should let those organs rest a while. How long do you want me to not drink? A year. Well, I haven't had anything to drink since April the 7th. This is May 28th. Maybe I can do that. Maybe. No, Judge, they said you don't understand. This is Labor Day weekend, and we want you to not drink from June the 1st, 1 year from June the 1st. Now, I know there are people in this room right now at this very moment who have already seized upon the injustice that these doctors were trying to foist upon me because I was getting no credit for my 7 weeks of continuous sobriety. I want you to know I fought for those 7 weeks. And this argument broke out between these learned physicians and this knuckleheaded judge. And we reached a compromise, and the compromise was I wouldn't drink until April the 7th. And then if I thought the pain and suffering which I had just endured for the past 7 weeks was in any way associated with the consumption of alcohol, then I could decide not to drink until June the 1st. And I left that hospital. I need to tell you that when I talk to people who are not in Alcoholics Anonymous and I tell them about the crime that they were trying to perpetrate by taking away my 7 weeks of continuous sobriety, normal people don't laugh at that. They look at me like I'm crazy. And of course, I am crazy. And that's one of the reasons I'm here tonight, because I'm crazy. Which, of course, then calls into question your sanity, because you're sitting in here listening to me. When I left the Johns Hopkins Hospital, I walked out into a world which I knew nothing about. A world without alcohol. In our book, it says, when you take alcohol away from an alcoholic, he becomes restless, irritable, and discontent. Well, I'll tell you, that's an understatement in my case. And I embarked upon the most incredible, most difficult, most insane experience of my entire life. I had no program. I had nothing. I was not drinking and not changing, and I was going stark, raving, crazy. My wife and I separated 3 times when I was drinking. And after I stopped drinking, we separated 3 times. I think that's a pretty clear indication that drinking had nothing to do with those separations. But I think alcoholism had everything to do with all 6 of those separations. Man, what a horrible, horrible way to live. Not drinking, not changing. Well, I could not drink because I definitely didn't want to end up like I'd been in that hospital. That just was not an option. Drinking was not an option. So what's a fella to do in that situation? What do we do when we can't go back to drinking? Well, we go for the fast suicide option. Can't do the slow suicide option. Go for the fast suicide option. Our sheriff had shot himself to death in the basement of our courthouse, and I felt that maybe if I shot myself on the top floor of the courthouse, that would give some symmetry to the building. That's my best thinking. I didn't look at it as a permanent solution to a temporary problem. As far as I was concerned, I had a permanent problem. I could never drink again, and I could not stand living like this. If not shooting myself, then how about a bridge abutment, accidental death? That would be good. That would be a good way to go. Youngest circuit court judge in the state of Maryland killed tragically in accident. I could see those headlines. 2 friends of mine, Bob and Ken, active members of Alcoholics Anonymous, saw that I was dying of untreated alcoholism. My dad, my alcoholic father, on July the 3rd, 1968, was walking by a Methodist church in Hagerstown, and the pastor put on the message board outside, "Don't buy a 5th on the 3rd for the 4th." My dad went to Alcoholics Anonymous that night, and he never drank again. And he was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he died with 15 years of continuous sobriety in this program. And I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous for my father's life. I carry his 15-year chip with my 24-year chip. And I hope in some way he knows tonight that I'm trying to give back to Alcoholics Anonymous in some small way to repay the debt that I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous for my father's sobriety. He lost everything of value in his life, everything of meaning. He lost that 30-year marriage to my mom. He lost my respect. He lost the respect of my sister. When my sister got married, he was not invited to the wedding because she was afraid he would come drunk, and I gave her away. He lost the opportunity to give his only daughter away in marriage because of alcoholism. And he showed up at that wedding and he showed up drunk. And you know, he came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and Alcoholics Anonymous gave him back his dignity, gave him back his worth as a man, and he became a man of integrity, the man God had created him to be all along. Now, Bob did not know my dad personally, but he knew my dad had died with 15 years of sobriety. And Bob said to me, "Jack, you know, we got this book in Alcoholics Anonymous. We call it the Big Book. Maybe you'd like to read that and find out about your father's illness." Clever guy, that Bob. I think we all know if he'd have said anything remotely close to, "We'd like you to read it so you'd find out about what's wrong with you," I wouldn't have touched it with a 10-foot pole, because there's nothing wrong with me. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm not drinking. Alcoholics drink. I'm not drinking. Ergo, not alcoholic. Everybody knows that. Mind your own damn business. Leave me the hell alone. I'm just fine. A little prickly, maybe, but fine. Well, I read the book that Bob wanted me to read, and not surprisingly, of course, my father is in there, and my father's in there because he's alcoholic. He's a real alcoholic, as described in the Big Book, so he belongs in there. The thing that came as a big surprise to me was it says in that book, many of us at an early age close the door on God. And you remember I told you what happened when I was 14 years old, and I thought I was the only one who had experienced something like that. And how could they put that in a book written before I was born? And then there's a thing in Bill's story where it talks about how he would go into the bar, swear he's not going to have anything to drink tonight, and then whiskey rising to his head, "My God, I've done it again. Oh, well, I might as well just stay here and get good and drunk. How many times did I go into the broad act saying, "I'm not going to have anything to drink tonight, nothing to drink tonight"? Well, maybe one, no more than two. And I'd tell my wife I was going to be home by 6, no later than 7. And at 9 o'clock, I'm still sitting there. And they've had dinner now. And she's putting the children to bed, and there's no point in going home now and having a row, so I'll just stay here till closing time. How many times did I do that? I'd like to say I only did it once or twice, but before I got sick, I was doing that almost every day of every week, of every month, of every year. Yeah, I'm in that Big Book. I had to concede to Ken and Bob that, well, maybe, just possibly, there was a slight possibility I had a mild, very mild case of alcoholism. We caught it just in time, just in time. And Bob and Ken would come to my chambers on Fridays, and they would bring their Big Book and their brown bag lunch, and we would read the Big Book together, and they would tell me of the importance of what we had read, and I would explain to them the true meaning of what we had read. Bob and Ken were carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous as it had been carried to them. They gave it to me straight from the shoulder. They didn't sugarcoat it. They didn't twist it. They just gave it to me from the Big Book because they knew that I didn't know. And I had no idea that they knew something that I didn't know, and I had no idea that they knew that I didn't know that they knew something that I didn't know, because if I'd have known that they knew something that I didn't know and that they knew that I didn't know, I'd have been very upset by that. But they were persistent and consistent in carrying this message to me. And then one day, finally, I came to realize that actually they knew something that I didn't know. But by that time, I knew what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And by that time, since I knew it, I wasn't so upset knowing that they knew something that I didn't know. So I didn't have to be upset knowing that they knew something and then I didn't know what it was that they knew. Now, if you followed any of that, you're in the right place. And if you found some of that a little confusing, you're still in the right place just means you don't know. Bob and Ken wanted me to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, but hey, listen, I'm not going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in Hagerstown. My God, I'm not going to go sit with those people. I'm populating the rooms. They're having this membership spike, remember? I can't do that, but I could go to meetings in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, or Martinsburg, West Virginia, or Frederick, Maryland, and I did do that. And at this time in my life, as I reflect back on it today, I realize what I had is what I would call tonight cake mix sobriety. And by that I mean if we were to go out to the local supermarket and we were to buy a box of Duncan Hines Red Velvet Cake Mix, you can trust me on this. On the back of that package, they have a three-step program for the production of a red velvet cake. Now, if I had that package up here at this podium, I could read that package to you. We could pass the box around the room, and you could read it to me. And I'm the kind of guy that, having read the back of that package and having read the three-step program for a red velvet cake, I start looking around for my cake. I haven't taken any action. I've just read the back of the box, and I'm looking for my cake. And Bob and Ken were coming to my office every Friday, and we were reading the big book, and I'm looking around for recovery. I'm not doing anything. I'm just reading the book. I'm looking for my red velvet cake, and I'm looking for my recovery, and I got neither. December 22nd, 1989 was a Friday. It was right before Christmas. The courthouse was closed, and Ken and Bob and I didn't have our Friday luncheon meeting in my chambers, but we just went out to lunch, and we didn't do the big book. We just had lunch, and we parted company. My wife and I were once again separated. I was living in an apartment. I went back to my apartment. I had a girlfriend at the time. I had a backup girlfriend just in case my girlfriend found out who I really was, and of course, I had a girlfriend for special occasions just in case. And I was managing this all quite well, by the way. Now, my wife objected to my backup girlfriend, and also she objected to my girlfriend for special occasions, and not surprisingly, all my girlfriends objected to my wife. But as I explained to Ken and Bob, I was handling this. If you're looking for an example of a delusional thought, that's a delusional thought right there. When I got to my apartment, propped against the door was a package that the postman had brought up. It was a Hickory Farms package. Somebody had sent the judge a sausage or a cheese log. I thought this was very nice. I went into my apartment. I was taking messages off the answering machine. I was trying to figure out how to get this box open. I finally saw the tape that had sealed it shut. I got my keys out. I slit the tape, and I started to lift the top of this box. Boom! And I was blown back against the wall. A federal appellate judge in Birmingham, Alabama, had been killed 10 days before by a package bomb that had been sent to his home. A lawyer in Savannah, Georgia, had been killed 5 days before by a package bomb that had been sent to his office. And I could smell the gunpowder, and I knew I'd opened a bomb. There was a fire. I tried to put the fire out. I couldn't. So I went out and hooked the fire alarm. My neighbor came with a fire extinguisher. I went back to dial 911 on the phone, and when I went to press the buttons, I became aware for the first time that part of my right hand had been blown away. And when I hung up the phone from that call, it felt as if somebody were trying to pull my pants off my hips, and I looked down on the floor, and I was standing in a puddle of blood that was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger as I stood there. And my neighbor asked if there was anything else he could do, and I asked him if he would get me a towel, and he did. And I opened my trousers, and I put the towel where I thought the wound was. I did not have the courage to try to visualize the wound. And I put my back against the wall, and I slid down onto the floor. And it was pretty clear to me I was going to die on that floor. I could feel life just draining out of me. And I was never going to see my wife again, or I was never going to see our children again. And I was just going to die on that floor, and I didn't know what to do, and I was terribly, terribly frightened. There's something wrong with my thinking. Simply how I think is, in fact, my problem. S-H-I-T, simply how I think is my problem. We have this pamphlet as AA for you with 12 questions with a little modification. Just bear with me here. Do you wish people would mind their own business about your thinking and stop telling you what to do? Do you envy people who can think without getting in trouble? Have you had problems connected with your thinking during the past year? Has your thinking caused trouble at home? Do you tell yourself you can stop thinking anytime you want to, even though you keep thinking when you don't mean to? Have you ever felt that your life would be better if you just did not think? Oh, yeah. Problem for the alcoholic centers in the mind. You know, in our book, it talks about the nine bedevilments, and it says that, we got these problem areas that we have a solution for. Trouble with relationships, couldn't control our emotional natures, prey to misery, prey to depression, couldn't make a living, feeling of uselessness, full of fear, unhappy, couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. I've come to understand that what that is all about is about daily living. That's life. That's life. Before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was mad and angry in the spring-loaded position, and I was just waiting for you to say something to me so that I could tell you where to head in. Resentment and anger were part of my daily life. I had no idea. I thought it was hand-to-hand combat on a daily basis. I did not know any other way to live. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I find out my purpose for being is to fit or equip myself to be of maximum service to God and to my fellow man. I didn't sign up for that. And we read how it works tonight, and some of you said in the ABCs, God could and would if he were sought. I didn't know that I was going to become a seeker of God. You know, most people go through their entire lives wondering if God exists. And you and I, we get to go through life watching God work on a daily basis. I was retired from the bench because of injuries I received in that explosion. I started practicing law. I saw an ad one day that said, be a lawyer in paradise. So as not to run this lead over, I'll just tell you that I became the attorney general of a nation called the Republic of Palau in the Western Pacific. And you may ask yourself, how does an alcoholic retired judge from Western Maryland become the attorney general of a country? And in my case, I answered a newspaper ad. So I called New York and I said, y'all have meetings in Palau? And they said, no, we don't. We got meetings in Guam. Guam's 2 hours by jet. They said, we'll send you a starter kit. You can start AA in Palau. I said, okay. So they sent me a box of everything you need to start a meeting in a small town or a small country. And I went to Palau. And within 72 hours, I was put in touch with a guy who might know something about AA, so I called him up. The very first phone call I made as Attorney General of this country, I called this fellow and I said, are you a friend of Bill W.'s? And he said, yes, I am. I said, do you all have meetings here in Palau? He said, yes, we do. I said, when do you meet? He said, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. I said, you didn't tell New York. He said, I didn't know I had to tell New York. Well, I said, you really didn't have to tell them, but, they like to know about these things. He says, we have a meeting tonight at 7:30. Why don't you come up? I said, I will. So I went back to my apartment, and, of course, when you're going to a new meeting in a new place, you want to dress right. It's a tropical climate, so I laid out my very fine AA T-shirts, and I had a black t-shirt, and you probably know you don't wear black t-shirts or black in a tropical climate, but this one said first things first on the front of it. And it was just crying out to me, wear me, wear me, wear me. So I put it on, and I went up to the National Hospital where they had the meeting, and there were three Americans there and four Palauans, and they welcomed me to the first things first group. I love a good God shot. You know, God does a bank shot just to show off. Let me know he's there. The longer I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, the less I know. The longer I'm here, the less I know. Problem for the alcoholic centers in the mind. Simply how I think is my problem. But here's something I know for sure. I know I'm here tonight because somebody prayed. I know my wife prayed. I know our children prayed. I know my mom prayed, even though she didn't think I was alcoholic. She just thought I was crazy. And somebody helped my boy. And I also know that every one of you here this evening who are alcoholic are here as a direct result of somebody praying. Maybe a lot of somebody's prayed. I don't know. I just think about all the things that had to happen in my life to bring me to this moment at this time, and all the things that had to happen in your life to bring you here at this moment at this time. And I know that this group of individuals assembled here this evening have never been assembled in the history of the world, and we will never be assembled again. And in our book, it says there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. And if you're new here, you're trying to decide whether you should or you shouldn't be here, let me tell you, if you have ever sat contemplating whether or not you have a problem with alcohol, I can assure you that people who do not have a problem with alcohol never wonder if they have a problem with alcohol. The only people who wonder if they have a problem with alcohol are those of us who have a problem with alcohol. You don't have to go out there and work on your story and create more misery for yourself. Stay here. There is nothing here that will harm you. Nothing here that will harm you. And if you're just coming back, or if you've been here a while and you're not happy, joyous, and free tonight, get with your sponsor. Talk to them about what you're doing or what you're not doing. Because this program is absolutely guaranteed to render the sufferer, that's me, happily and usefully whole. It is guaranteed to allow me to live happy, joyous, and free today. And if that's not your experience today, then talk to your sponsor and see what you can be doing. What's the big book suggest that we do so that we can live happy, joyous, and free? I have a pamphlet here called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. I suspect many of you are familiar with it. I hope that those of you who are not will get a copy of it. If you don't have a copy of it, I hope you will get one. I hope you will give a copy of it to every person you sponsor. I think it's the finest piece of the literature we have in Alcoholics Anonymous outside of the big book. Tomorrow, in the churches of many of us, there will be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew, which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod. And hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another? And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but he wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit, those who burned with an inner hunger and an inner thirst, and that the word gospel meant quite literally the good news. A number of years ago, two men, Bob and Ken, working singly and together, maneuvered me into AA. Tonight, if they were present and were to ask me, tell us, Jack, what did you find? I would have to say to them what I say to you now. I can tell you only what I have heard and seen. It seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise. And over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may always be so. My name is Jack. I am an alcoholic. Thank you for letting me share.
Recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.